Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, next week in Singapore, Bloomberg is hosting something called the New Economy Forum. And the idea with this forum is that it's going to be dedicated to talking about emerging economies around the world, which largely come from EMEA and South America, Latin America, Africa. And so I wanted to take this episode of Trillions to sort of talk about an investing lens that's different than one that we usually talk about, because we haven't done this on the show yet, talking about countries outside of the developed world.
Right. Yeah. So this would be emerging markets and then frontier countries, which is sort of like the
JV. There's actually like official classifications.
Yes, that's right. And some get promoted. It does remind me of, you know, freshman year JV and varsity in terms of the way it's like a three-pronged system. But in the emerging and frontier areas, there's a lot of opportunity. There's a lot more volatility. Just to put some numbers on this, in the ETF world, emerging markets ETFs as a whole, like when you invest in the whole region at once, have $174 billion. That's a lot. That's 6-7% of all ETF assets. Mm-hmm. But the countries, when you go into a specific country in the emerging markets, those ETFs only have $41 billion. So that's just over 1% of the assets. And most people who use those are traders. But I mean, to mom and pop, if you are very interested in a country that's, you know, way out there, way developing, ETFs serve up almost all of them at this point that are investable, from Vietnam to Argentina to Egypt. There was just one for Pakistan. You can now, and back in the day, this was very difficult to get local shares of these countries. You needed to know people. Now you can just buy it like buying shares of Microsoft. So when we sometimes talk about ETF sort of democratizing investing, this is a great example. Now anybody can get these countries. They're literally delivered to your doorstep. And that's one of the reasons they're fairly popular and growing.
Speaking of growing, the population of these countries that we're talking about, when you look at IMF numbers for them, if you take emerging and developing and put them all together, we're talking about 85% of the world's population. So this could be, I mean, when you really step back and think about it, it's like the long-term growth play, because there's so much potential in these economies.
Yeah, and the U.S. market is, by a market cap, is so dominant in disproportion to the number of people we have. So you're right, there's a bit of an imbalance in terms of the size of our stock market and the number of people and the growth potential of over there. Although I will say, and I hope we bring this up in the discussion, there are many times when a country has a good story written about it, looks like there's a lot of growth, the PE is low, and it just doesn't go up. In fact, it could go down worse. And so there is a lot of risk.
Can't wait to talk about that.
And so for this discussion, because yours truly knows the ETFs very well, but I don't know every single country out there. In fact, sometimes I have to scramble. It's like doing a book report. Oh, talk about Vietnam today. Okay, I got to look at Wikipedia and do my homework. But rather than me doing that, we brought in a couple experts from Van Eck who are specialists in these countries and do nothing but look at them all day.
And if you want to learn more about the New Economy Forum, there's a great new podcast. You've heard it teased in our feed before. The host is Stephanie Flanders, and the name of the show is The New Economy. This week on Trillions, around the world in ETFs. We have a couple guests. Ola, Patricia, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Yes, thank you for having us.
So you guys are at Van Eck. Can you describe what you do there?
Sure. I'm Ola El Shawarbi. I'm one of the senior analysts on the Emerging Markets Equity Fund at Van Eck, more on the active side than the ETF, but happy to be here and talk about the countries I look at.
And Patricia?
Yes, I'm Patricia Gonzalez. I'm also a senior analyst at Van Eck and focusing more on Latin America and a couple of countries in Asia, and very happy to be here.
And, you know, they are from the active side. You hear that? So a lot of these shops have both ETFs and active mutual funds. And so
Lunch is really interesting.
Yeah. I'm sure there's some tension you can cut with a knife. No, I'm just kidding. The reason that we would get somebody from the active side is the ETF product specialists are just not going to know as much, because they're out there looking for individual stocks in these areas. So they're the perfect people for this, even though we tend to normally have ETF people on. Need to work in an ETF company, though. So you're kind of into it a little bit, but yeah. Okay.
So how do you guys look at the difference between frontier and emerging markets? Because that's sort of frontier is more JV, and then you get promoted to, or I guess Frontier is freshman. JV.
Emerging markets is JV.
And then you get into the developed world. So how do you guys look at it through your investing lens?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the classification that most people follow tends to be from the index classification by MSCI. But as far as we're concerned, we really are looking for countries that offer longer-term development and growth opportunities, whether it's on the emerging side, whether it's on the frontier side. We kind of don't really care as much. Frontier markets tend to have less experience with foreign institutional investors. Some of the liquidity in some of those markets can be more challenging. Some of the capital market laws are still being developed, so they tend to be a bit earlier stage, let's say, in their cycle of development. Mm-hmm. So we're always mindful of that when we do our analysis and due diligence on companies and countries. But I think we're looking for opportunity, and we can find that. I mean, there are shared characteristics between both in terms of typically having larger populations, younger populations, so a lot of runway for growth going forward.
Yes, I agree with Ola. I mean, in a particular case, we look at either emerging or frontier. And the main characteristic, like she says, a lot of the frontier market lack the liquidity still, and they have a capital market that is not very developed. But certainly, like you said, there are still very good opportunities. The demographic is there, so there's a lot of opportunity in both.
So with that said, obviously you're just looking for countries, a lot of growth. Let's just jump in and talk about Brazil.
Sure.
An interesting one.
This is sort of the, like I said, the soccer ball is always landing on one of these countries at some point. And right now it's on Brazil because they just had an election. And as I tell people, single country emerging markets ETFs like nothing better than a pro-business conservative leader elected.
That's correct.
Is that right? So walk us through what happened, because EWZ, which tracks Brazil, is up 20% in October. Now, you know how bloody and brutal October was for everybody else. So that's how much they really like this election.
And this election was a little controversial, to say the least. It had a lot of attention.
That's correct. Well, like you said, last Sunday they had the presidential elections, and Jair Bolsonaro, who was a former army captain and a congressman, won the election. The other candidate was Fernando Haddad, which was part of the Workers' Party, more on the left. That was the party of former President Lula da Silva. So definitely Bolsonaro, the more market-friendly of the two. And his victory was already anticipated by the market, and that's one of the main reasons why we saw a very good rally on the equity side over the last month. And the expectation that he's going to be very, market friendly. I mean, the most important thing for him to do is really tack on the fiscal side. That's a main issue for Brazil. The fiscal deficit is really one of the largest in emerging markets. But he said the right things, and I think that's one of the main focus of his new government. So if that's the case, I mean, we can really see Brazil accelerating GDP growth in a positive environment going forward.
And in the case of something like a leader, is that worth 20%? I mean, since the election, it's kind of gone flat. So people were buying the rumor, so to speak. But is that overbought? In other words, when you're looking to play a single country like this, should you, buy in after a rally like that? Or do you think the fundamental value of the stocks that you analyze are not really tied up to the pricing now, that there was this sort of like top-down buying because of an election?
Well, I think the fundamentals of the companies are there, and I do believe there's still more opportunity. A lot of people are comparing Brazil with what happened to India in 2014 when Modi was elected president, and the equity market had a really big rally, and the expectations of economic growth and reforms. So I do think that if the president do the right things, in particular on the fiscal side, there's a lot of opportunity for Brazil going forward in terms of growth. The conditions are already good there. I mean, you see that interest rates are low, you see low inflation, and you have seen some pickup in economic numbers and also on labor markets. So I do believe that under the right circumstances, with the right economic cabinet and with the right reforms, I really see Brazil can really continue re-rating and inflows continue to come to the country.
So with something like Brazil, and at VanEck. How do you guys try and get exposure if you like what you see, if you like those conditions?
Yeah, in our particular case, we are very bottom-up. Like I mentioned, we're on the active side. So for us, it's very important to find companies when we see visible and structural and growth and profitability. And we continue to see that in many sectors within Brazil, I mean, education sector, healthcare sector. And I believe valuations are still very reasonable. So we continue to find very good opportunities there.
And if you look, VanEck, I know you guys are on the active side, but VanEck has a Brazil ETF. It's a small cap one. The ticker's BRF. And I do find after when these elections are happening and they're sort of positive for the market, the small cap will zip up a little faster. Do you go and look at small caps too? Because the big single country EM ETFs tend to be dominated by the banks, financials. And you got to go down to the small caps to get a more broader swath of the economy. Is that right?
Is that correct? Because usually, the small cap are the ones that represent a lot of the smallest sector. I mean, like you said, the majority of the companies that have the largest weight on the index, not only the banks, but also like Petrobras or the Vales. And we really find the opportunities are in some of these small caps, in like a small healthcare companies that are taking opportunity of the market, and or education companies like I mentioned in the past. So I do believe that a lot of the opportunities, specifically domestic opportunities, are within the small caps.
Although you definitely have to take something before you buy this, because these things are volatile. Both EWZ and BRF are 3 to 4 times the volatility of the S&P 500.
Pepto-Bismol? Is that what you take before you?
Yeah, you could get something over the counter. You don't have to go that.
You don't have to go prescription?
No, you don't have to go on the streets for this. Okay. it's not like Bitcoin or VIX, T-VIX or anything. Okay. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of volatility. You have to stomach this volatility. Yeah, that's the downside. That's the cost to potentially getting the benefit from this, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, well, the issue sometimes with some of these smaller caps is liquidity. So that's why if you want to build a position or exit a position with the lower liquidity, that tends to create more volatility. But like Patricia mentioned, if you are investing in emerging markets and, you know, as we talked about with favorable demographics, you want to get exposure to some of these more domestic themes, because even though they're smaller companies, they tend to probably offer better valuations and higher growth over time. Mm-hmm. And they tend to be less correlated with global events. So if you take Petrobras, that's really moving much more with the global commodity cycle rather than with the fundamentals of Brazil domestically. So, I mean, that's why we tend to find more interesting ideas and also less covered, so more unique idiosyncratic ideas in the smaller and medium cap space.
Right. How long will you hold a position someplace like this where there is this much volatility? You see that there's opportunity. How long will you bury in to hold on to something that you believe in?
Oh, I mean, we're long-term investors, and when there's structural growth, and especially like the small cap that are in sectors that are more domestic, usually they're irrespective of what is happening in the country, we continue to see a very good growth. So, if the fundamentals of the companies are there and we continue to see that, definitely we're long-term investor, unless the story change, and, then that's a different situation. But
And when you say long-term, what's that horizon look like for you?
It can be up to 1-3 years or definitely.
Gunlock said, buy India and don't look at your statement for 30 years. So there's long term.
Yeah, definitely.
That's definitely a way to deal with the volatility, because you just don't look at it. But you have to really commit to the country. In your case, your 1 to 3 years long term for you. And in the case of Brazil, did the election confirm what you already knew, or did it actually like make you buy a little more of the country?
Oh, well, definitely we're more positive than now. We got a president and he's more market friendly. There are still uncertainties because, I mean, he's brand new. He's somebody that is way to the right.
That's right. This is like the farthest right
Brazil has gone. The farthest right that Brazil has gone.
Right?
He's a former military. So we don't know what really can happen. We have good expectations. And we are waiting to see what kind of cabinet he will have and, what are the kind of policies that he will put in place. But definitely.
So Brazil is not the only country in South America.
No.
Can we talk about the rest of the continent?
Yeah. Another interesting country, I think we can talk about it, is Peru. They also have a very interesting ETF. But Peru, it's a small country. A lot of people don't look at it. It's a small part of the MSCI index, but it's a very interesting country. It's the fastest growing one of the fastest growing in the region.
And it's actually a really interesting one in relation to the MSCI index, because it didn't it get down, like the percentage dedicated to the index in Peru shrunk dramatically?
Well, because they didn't have enough, the liquidity that they
The market cap is not that big.
It's not that big. That's correct. I mean, the largest constituent is Credit Corp, which is the largest bank there. And then you have another couple of companies, which is Southern Copper and Buenaventura. But yeah, definitely there's not a lot of name within the...
The whole basketball metaphor with freshman to JV to varsity. Sometimes a country can be a big deal on the freshman team, and then when it gets promoted, it's like ninth man on JV, and that is Peru. It's only 0.44% in the MSCI emerging markets. Israel was a good example. That dominated the emerging markets. Not dominated, but it had a good weighting, and it's basically lost now in the developed world. But what's interesting is EPU, which is the iShares Peru ETF. Listen to the returns on this. It's up 60% in 3 years. The S&P is up 36, and the emerging markets index as a whole is up 16%.
So Peru S&P.
Yeah, and tripled its own index. So in these cases, you kind of have to use a single country, right, if you want to get exposure. And why is it up that much? What's going on there?
Well, when we look at Peru, it's a country that depends a lot on metal prices for their growth. And, I mean, you can see that they're second largest producer of copper, silver, the third largest producer of zinc. They also produce gold. So, I mean, metal prices has been in a very good recovery, and that have really helped their GDP and their growth. And when we look at the index, a lot of the companies are commodity companies. So definitely they have had a good performance.
So if Peru's been a bright spot, and especially a bright spot, what's been not so bright?
Well, that's the case of Argentina. Argentina is a completely different case. Actually, back in June, the MSCI index included Argentina.
Which was a big deal.
It was a big deal. It was a big deal. But unfortunately, it came during a time of a lot of volatility for Argentina. You know, the changes that they were happening global and domestically really made Argentina in a very vulnerable state. I mean, it's a country with a high twin deficits and, you know, like tighter global liquidity. They had a drought. All the things, you know, created the perfect storm for them at the same time that they were being upgraded or graduating for, you know, to the emerging market.
This thing is down 30% this year. Which is the year it got promoted, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. Well, they announced that they will be promoted. So, yeah, usually it takes like six months.
When was the announcement?
Back in June, May, June this year.
Yeah, it didn't really do much.
No.
This is why some people do try to play that promotion, because they're anticipating all this foreign capital coming in. But it doesn't always work. There are macro issues which can trump that game.
And if there's one place that foreign capital has reservations about, it tends to be Argentina.
Well, yeah, there's been a roller coaster Argentina over the years.
So as an investor who can, you know, look at a continent like this and see that Brazil has this long-term opportunity, Peru's having outperformance, Argentina's not doing as well as you might want, how do you put your thesis together based on those factors?
Well, definitely there's more positive macro news in Peru and Brazil. But in the case of Argentina, I mean, we saw that under this situation, they were able to find a loan from the IMF for over $50 billion, which really cover a lot of the financing needs over the next few years. And they're doing the reforms. I mean, right now we started to see some stability on the currency, and expectations are that hopefully things will get better. But there's another issue that all this is happening at the time when presidential elections will occur next year. So definitely we don't know what could happen in that sense. There can be a lot of volatility, in particular that thinking that the old political party, the Kirchner or the Peronistas, you know, will come back to power. But there are opportunities in Argentina. I mean, it's a country, in particular, when you look demographic is very good. There's a high middle class and very low penetration of banking. So opportunities are there, just on the you know, better environment, or at least see that things started to move in the right direction.
Okay, I want to turn the globe slightly, and we're going to turn from South America to Asia. There's one country in particular I want to talk about in Asia, which is South Korea. And South Korea is classified as an emerging market, and it's been stuck there, Eric. It's like perpetual JV. It's like the guy who can't get onto the varsity squad. What's going on there?
Yeah, so South Korea is considered developed in the FTSE line of indexes, but in the MSCI, it's still emerging. It's the rare country that has different views there. But most people use MSCI, so they consider it emerging. And the reason it's still there, remember we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and we weren't sure. I got a tweet, and I'll give this guy credit, Quant of Asia. He's actually a good follow. He says, South Korea is still considered an emerging market because of capital controls and investor ID requirements. Can't buy Korea stocks in certain ways. So I think that's – it's not the country itself. It's these regulations and controls which is holding it back.
So what are the other Asia ETF that you keep an eye on?
Well, Taiwan, that's one of the bigger ones. That's an 11% weighting in the emerging markets. So for most investors, they're getting plenty of Taiwan in their broad one. But then, you know, they've got countries that have less weighting, like a Vietnam. That is very underrepresented in a lot of these indexes. And there is a Market Vectors has the Vietnam ETF, which is $320 million, actually. But there's it's such a hard country to get local shares in that I believe you guys limit creations now and then because, like, if there's a rush of creations, you have to limit them to two a day or something. But regardless, if you try doing that on your own, you have a lot of difficulty. So you do have Vietnam here is an ETF that's available. And let's look at what it's doing year to date. It's down 14.7%. I mean, everything we've brought up today, with the exception of Brazil, is having a rough year. I mean, it's just been a rough year. Remember, the U.S. was beating everybody. Now the U.S. has gotten its big haircut. It's down to zero this year. But all the other stuff was already in the red. Brazil is the only outlier.
In Peru.
Well, no, Peru. That it had a rough year, too. That return was over
three
the long
years.
Term.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to twist the globe slightly to Mia. And this is Ola's wheelhouse. So, Ola, what are the countries that most interest you?
Yeah, I think one of the countries that we like at the moment and that's a bit of its own story is Egypt. If you recall, you know, in 2011 with the Arab Spring, the country went into a phase of political instability and a lot of change, which also had economic implications. So the growth slowed down. You also had a lot of your foreign currency sources disappear, basically foreign investment, even tourism because of the turbulence and all of that. So what ended up happening is the country's foreign reserves were depleted, and that created further uncertainty because you also had some issues with capital repatriation. So if you had invested at the time, you got stuck on your way out. So that created a lot of risk aversion against the country, and it was a very difficult time, obviously. That changed in the last few years after we had, we entered a more politically stable environment with the election of President Sisi. And after that, some more market-friendly policies were adopted. And namely, the main thing that happened was a significant adjustment of the currency value end of 2016. So the currency ended up losing half its value and, you know, effectively being freely floated, which was a problem before. And that was kind of a trigger point for foreign investments to start coming back, especially because at the time when the country did that, we also, I'm saying we because I'm Egyptian, so forgive me.
I do that with ETF sometimes. I'm like, from ETF.
We're with you.
Egypt basically managed to secure also an IMF package. And that tends to be something that provides comfort and confidence to foreign investors in particular, because what comes with that is a package of reforms. So we started seeing a floating currency regime, an IMF program that basically mandated fiscal consolidation, which was a significant problem that the country was facing. So naturally, that put the country on track for a recovery process. It doesn't mean it came without pain. So 2017, right after, was a very difficult year because with the currency devaluation comes a lot of inflation because the country is quite dependent on imports. Also, that means that the consumer came under pressure. So you had a lot of difficulties on the companies with cost inflation, higher interest rates, higher inflation overall, and a weaker consumer. But the good news is...
I love that, but...
Yeah, the good news is...
Interactive manager.
Yeah. You saw, you know, Egypt as a case in general has always been interesting for investors because, you know, similar to what we mentioned before about a lot of EM and frontier countries, 100 million people, very young population, so roughly 50% of the population is younger than 25 years old. And also very underserved. And you have consumption per capita being quite low on very basic goods like milk, like, you know, the most basic of consumer products. So there's a lot of growth opportunity there. So with this reform package that started, foreign investors started looking back at the market, and we started seeing inflows first on the fixed income side, but also in the equity market as well. The valuations remain quite reasonable. So now you're starting to see GDP growth recover again, getting closer to the 5% level. Inflation after 2017 is starting to be on a declining trend, which is obviously positive. Interest rates are still high, so we haven't really seen a lot of capital expenditure by companies yet. But what the companies have been doing is paying back their debt, managing their costs, and so trying to get like very efficient with how they use capital and how they manage their cash flows. So we are actually setting up for a period where you start seeing consumption recovery in a more significant fashion, companies that are more efficient and ready to invest, and valuations that are very reasonable. So Egypt is trading at a discount to the broader EM, even though if you look at the growth rates, they are significantly higher than what the broader EM offers in the next three-year period. So we like to usually look at PEG ratio, which is how much you're paying for every unit of growth. And in Egypt's case, I think it's around 0.5.
Now, you said you just made this strong case. Let me push back a little bit. So there is an ETF, EGPT. It is down big this year. And it looks like it's been a struggle for the past couple of years, a couple of nice spikes. But I mean, when will this pay off? Are there bigger macro issues that sort of suppress everything you just said?
I mean, I think I wouldn't say there. So I've mentioned that we're coming from a very difficult period, right? So I'm always looking forward. 2017 was difficult because for the country to stabilize the currency after the devaluation, the central bank had to go ahead and hike interest rates quite significantly. And that put pressure on companies as well, even though, broadly speaking, the Egyptian companies are under-leveraged. But you still suffer from like higher interest rates, so higher cost of debt, a weaker consumer, and just cost inflation that was very significant. Now, I think we're coming closer to the end of that period, and you're bound to see the recovery. We were hoping, and I think that holds true for the broader investment community, we were hoping that interest rates would start coming down faster than what we are actually seeing. Unfortunately, because the country was subsidizing fuel prices and has been gradually eliminating these subsidies, when oil prices increased again this year, that put again some pressure on the fiscal side of things and forced the country to go through further subsidy removal, yep, which again, you know, affected inflation and made it harder to bring down the interest rates as fast as we were hoping. So I think once we pass through this period and you start seeing interest rates coming down and companies going back to an investment cycle, then you should start seeing the market also react more positively.
This is why people outsource this to mutual funds and ETFs. That is very complicated. It almost reminds you of a pilot going over all the things in the cockpit. Like, what did you say? Look, this is very important. Egypt, by the way, is even more lost than Peru. It's only a 0.14% weighting in emerging markets. So you're just not getting Egypt if you're out there pretty much unless you use EGPT, which, by the way, during the Arab Spring, this ETF was famous because the stock market closed for 2 months, right? And the ETF traded. And that's sometimes the ETF becomes like a futures contract on a market. And then when the market opens, the prices usually come back up to where the ETF was trading, even though it looks like the ETF is trading at a premium. Now, this does lead us to Africa in general. Sometimes it's called this like the lion, the Asia tiger, the African lion. I've looked at Africa many times. Again, VanEck has another ETF called AFK. It's the only pure Africa ETF. Egypt is a huge weighting. Let me give you numbers on Africa, okay? AFK, this is over the last 6 years since it came out. Africa is down 25%. The emerging markets index is up 4%, so flat. The frontier market index is up 30%. So Africa has underperformed, and of course the U.S. is crushing all that. It's really like the bottom-dwelling area of the whole world in terms of returns, and its P/E is down to what, like 10 or 11? I mean, if somebody likes bargains, this seems to be like a bargain buy. What would help the whole continent beyond Egypt actually reach this potential that so many people see?
Yeah, I mean, Africa, like you mentioned, it's kind of it's kind of a continent that's quite interesting, and people always have this hope that Africa will provide a lot of growth opportunity, which I think long term it would, just by virtue again of demographics and how underserved a lot of these countries are. For example, Nigeria.
Yeah, Nigeria, South Africa, Kenya. Like, all, like there are, like even within Africa, like there are some places that we think will rise to sort of like this frontier emerging market level and really be resilient.
Right. And I think, I mean, that there is a lot of merit to that argument over the long term. So I'm definitely a believer in the continent over the long term. The issue, and it really varies by country, but a lot of these countries have faced their fair share of political events and, you know, changes in leadership, different things that have, in the short term, created a lot of difficulties and volatility. So if you think about South Africa, when you got Cyril Ramaphosa in office,
which happened earlier this year,
there was a lot of hope and a lot of euphoria around the Ramaphosa win. And, you know, I think the issue there is you haven't, given that they have general elections coming up next year, the window this year was difficult for him to really come through with some of the structural reforms that the country would need to recreate growth and to become more exciting as an investment destination. And in particular, in South Africa's case, the issue there is also you have a significant domestic investor base, so a lot of domestic institutional money that has to invest in South Africa. So for the level of growth that's being offered, South Africa is really not that cheap. So the hope is next year, after we pass through the election cycle, we start seeing some promising structural reform, and then we go into a more interesting, hopefully, recovery cycle. But we haven't seen that come through yet, so that's unfortunate. In the case of Nigeria, which is kind of, the most, in some ways, one of the most interesting countries, given the size of the population and theoretically, this should be a black horse in many ways, given that it's also an energy-rich country. It has been very unfortunate. I remember I was in Nigeria in 2015, right after Buhari won. And again, at the time, there was a lot of hope that, you know, he would come through combating corruption, which is one of the most significant issues in Nigeria, given that,
yeah,
you know,
it's very high on the corruption scale.
It's very high on the corruption scale. And you went through a significant period of high oil prices. But at the same time, the reserves weren't nearly where they were supposed to be from the perspective of the country really benefiting. Right. And a lot of that is because of corruption, unfortunately. Right. And he was also supposed to bring back security, introduce economic reform. There has been a sense that there was under-delivering on the part of the Buhari administration. Now, again, we're going into an election cycle next year in February with Buhari and another candidate, opposition candidate, contesting this election. So I think we're going through a period of uncertainty in Nigeria. Again, no doubt oil prices are a bit more supportive this year in terms of improving growth and improving the availability of foreign currency. Mm-hmm. But for you to really see, you know, an improvement in income per capita, which then is going to be supportive for consumption, you need to see structural reform.
So I have one more. If we started with a political hot potato with Brazil, there's one other country, Saudi Arabia, that's also been in the headlines recently.
Yes.
So we can bookend this with Brazil and then Saudi Arabia. So how do you look at Saudi Arabia now through an investing lens, considering all the turmoil of recent weeks in the headlines?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously quite fresh. And I mean, I'm not sure I know a lot more about anything specifically related to the recent headlines than what you see on the news. But generally speaking, I mean, Saudi, again, is in the context of the MENA region, one of the more interesting countries because, you know, it's also a very young population and overall wealth level and infrastructure development and so on is a bit better than your average emerging mm-hmm. market. And you have a market that's actually quite liquid, which is unusual for some of, for at least the MENA region, it's the most liquid one. The country went through its own share of problems with the decline in oil prices in 2015. So they were forced to start looking, you know, reflecting at how they run the economy and trying to diversify away from oil over time with the Vision 2030. I mean, I think the delivery on that has been maybe a little less than what we were hoping. But I would say high level, probably the worst from an economic standpoint is behind us because you did go through a significant fiscal adjustment, at least in the context of Saudi. So overall, going forward, I think we are probably more cautiously optimistic for a recovery. The other thing with Saudi, to your point about, you know, the index inclusion and these sort of graduation events, Saudi is actually now not part of any index, but because of the size of the market and the liquidity there, it's actually being included right away in the emerging markets index. And the announcement came by both MSCI and FTSE over the course of the last few months. So we are looking at an event as well where you're bound to see index inclusion. And given its size, it's actually going to be a relatively significant weight of the MSCI EM index and probably one of the higher weights in the EMEA region. So you should start seeing a lot more investors looking at it. Certainly passive money would have to, you know, revisit the country, which it has afforded to ignore for such a long period. So I think some uncertainties for sure. Headlines, right. Definitely not great. Well,
they're interesting.
Well, let me give you the numbers. I personally think in the case of this recent, where the journalist was killed, horrible situation. Okay, it was bad. However, it didn't do that much to the ETF. It's up 42% in the last 2 years. It did hurt it like a couple percentage points. But this year, year to date, this thing is still up 16%.
Ola, Patricia from VanEck, thank you so much for joining us on Trillions. You can say...
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. That was great.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. And you can follow VanEck at VanEck_US. Trillions is produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.